From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! More on the Headwaters pepper spray case. We'll speak with Pacific Lumber and the environmental groups who are taking the company on. Then a conversation with Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer. First, she took on the military when they tried to throw her out for being a lesbian. Now, she's running for Congress. And the trouble with Dilbert, how corporate culture gets the last laugh. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Muslim militant Al-Gamaa al-Islamiyya, which has claimed responsibility for Monday's slaying of at least 58 foreign tourists in Luxor, Egypt, is one of several groups fighting to install a fundamentalist Islamic state in Egypt. The Egyptian government has tried to break the back of militant groups with tough security crackdowns, which have been criticized, but they keep resurfacing with violent attacks to rattle the authorities. Al-Gamaa al-Islamiyya, the largest group fighting to overthrow President Hosni Mubarak's government, launched a violent campaign in 1992 targeting security forces, police, and Coptic Christians. Its attacks on foreigners in Nile cruise boats, trains, and at popular tourist sites have dealt severe blows to Egypt's attempts to safeguard its $3 billion a year tourism industry. The group is inspired by its leader, Sheikh Omar Abdurrahman, a fiery, blind cleric serving a jail term in the United States for conspiring to blow up New York landmarks. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright will meet Egyptian Foreign Minister Amr Moussa during a brief refueling stop at Cairo Airport on Wednesday. They say Moussa will go to the airport, this according to foreign ministry sources, to see Albright, who's cut short a visit to India to hasten to Geneva. She plans to join her Russian, British, and French counterparts there for an emergency meeting on the Iraqi crisis. This news from Oslo. A Norwegian lesbian priest who married her female lover in defiance of church rules triggered a storm of controversy in Norway's parliament today. Prime Minister Kjell Magne Bondevik, himself an ordained priest in Norway's state Lutheran church, defended Church Affairs Minister John Lilton for saying the priest, Siri Sunday, should resign. Bondevik said during question time, "I don't think it's improper for the minister to react now," adding that Littleton also made clear the church itself would deal with this. Bondevik also noted that Bishop Rosemary Cohn, Norway's first female bishop who ordained Sunday, felt the priest had broken a promise by entering a legal gay marriage this year with her lesbian partner. Norway's church allows women to become priests but bars active gays, those living with a homosexual partner, from doing so. A man who was convicted of killing and raping a 9-year-old boy was executed in Illinois today, just an hour after the state injected a lethal dose of drugs into a jewelry store thief who killed two men. "I love Jesus Christ, my Lord," the thief said. His name was Walter Stewart, in a final statement. Ohio's ban on certain late-term abortions, the first of many such laws enacted across the country, is unconstitutional and cannot be enforced. This, according to a federal appeals court ruling. U.S. District Judge Walter Rice of Dayton ruled in December of 1995 the law imposed unacceptable burdens on a woman's life, health, and right to choose an abortion. His decision was upheld yesterday in a 2-1 ruling by a 3-judge panel of the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Algeria, apparently reacting to a human rights group accusing its armed forces of massacring civilians, said today it is committed to protect human rights. Algeria's Abdallah Bali, its representative at the United Nations, said in a statement Algeria would not tolerate any violation of human rights as much as it would not accept any selective criticism. Bali was quoted by Algerian state-run radio as addressing a UN committee in New York. The London-based Amnesty International said yesterday some 80,000 people had been killed in Algeria, but that governments at the United Nations deliberately avoided taking any action. Amnesty said in parts of Algeria, especially in poor areas where oil and money do not flow, the civilian population, increasingly impoverished, is denied the protection of the state and lives in fear of massacres and attacks. Thousands of civilians have died in remote areas throughout the country, including in poor areas of the capital, Algiers, in massacres which the authorities blame on Muslim rebels. And an Arkansas gun collector said a letter he wrote to Timothy McVeigh before the Oklahoma City bombing, saying the plan is to bring the country down, was just a ruse. The letter was written in April of 1995 after Roger E. Moore concluded McVeigh was probably responsible for the theft of 70 weapons from Moore's home. Moore testified yesterday at Terry Nichols' trial. Prosecutors contend Nichols carried out the robbery to finance the April 19, 1995 bombing that killed 168 people. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Openly gay and lesbian political candidates are becoming a bit more commonplace around America at local and state levels, but not in the nation's capital. Out of 435 members of Congress, only two are openly gay: Barney Frank of Massachusetts and Jim Colby, a Republican from Arizona. Both of them came out after they were elected. But things may be changing. Margaret Kammermeyer, a retired Army colonel and out lesbian, declared her candidacy this week for a House seat in her Washington State district. She's challenging two-term Republican incumbent Jack Metcalf. She was the co-chair this year in the campaign for Initiative 877, a Washington State ballot measure that would extend job protections to gay men and lesbians. And she joins us on the phone right now from her home in Bellingham, Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't we first start off by reviewing the battle you had with the military over your being a lesbian and the military not accepting or the military trying to kick you out?
Well, they succeeded in kicking me out. There was a policy at that time. This was in 1982, it turned out that there was a policy that had changed so that if you were gay, that was considered incompatible with military service. I was going up before a security clearance, and as part of that security clearance, said that I was a lesbian. This was something that I had found out about myself very late in life, and I had never interfered with my ability to serve. There had never been any question about that throughout my career. But as a result of that statement, there was a major investigation about whether or not what I said was really true. They subsequently, over the next 2.5 years, ended up discharging me from the military. We filed a lawsuit in federal court, and the policy was declared unconstitutional, and that still remains to this day, that the premise of the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell law was unconstitutional. I was reinstated in the military then 25 months later and resumed my military career without any difficulty or without any problem, and just moved on because it was a non-issue, and then retired in March of this past year, or of this year.
Margaret Kammermeyer, can you talk about your political activities this year before you announced this week?
Well, you know, the two are really totally unrelated in terms of working as co-chair on Initiative 677, which was a very straightforward initiative introduced here in the state of Washington, which has a process by which if citizens would like to have something placed on the ballot, that they do that by collecting signatures. So that was accomplished over this year, that more than 220,000 signatures were collected from Washingtonians who felt that discrimination in the workplace was unconstitutional. And that was our effort then to include that in the civil rights protection here in the state of Washington. So that did end up going on the ballot, and it was defeated, as well as all of the other initiatives here in the state. There's a lot of, you know, Saturday night, or I guess nowadays it would be Tuesday night quarterbacking about why initiatives don't succeed and have such a difficult time. And that was, you know, just part of what I was doing this year, but really has no bearing and was not influential in determining whether or not I would run for office this next year.
What made you decide to run for Congress?
Well, I think the main issues for me were that we are being represented by someone that many of us don't feel reflects our values and the way and direction that we would like to see America go, that we see the gradual erosion of support for families, both young and old. You know, you can't support family values and then take away the structure that is in place to try to protect them, both in terms of educational opportunities, in terms of health care, in terms of looking at what sort of support is there in the future and in the aging process. So there's been this progressive erosion of support to families and for families to succeed in their just day-to-day jobs that now exist, as well as the attempt to sort of chip away at how we have been trying to protect the environment. You know, if we continue to give away the protections to the environment, there isn't going to be a legacy for our children and grandchildren. And, you know, so trying to look at those broad perspectives, I think here in the state of Washington, and particularly in the northwest corner, we also have an extraordinary problem with transportation. I used to have a five-hour daily commute to work and back on top of a regular workday. And, you know, that's not unique to me. That is sort of common problems. We're the fourth worst city in the nation, and in the greater Seattle area, the I-5 corridor having to do with transportation. So, I mean, it just goes on and on, the difficulties that I see and how I really feel and have talked to many people now who feel that we need a different voice there.
We're talking to Colonel. Do you call yourself Colonel now?
No.
Okay.
I am retired from the military. I have a PhD. But I also go just by Greta.
Well, we're talking to Greta Cammermeyer from Bellingham, Washington. Actually, we have a community radio station in Bellingham, Washington, KUGS. I was just speaking to them the other day, that runs Democracy Now! As well as the Pacifica News and is affiliated with the university there.
Mm-hmm.
Greta Cammermeyer, who is now running for Congress from her area in Washington State. What happens now? What is the process in Washington State? When is your primary? Who will you be taking on, both in terms of Democrats, Republicans, and others?
Well, I thought that the whole business having to do with running for election had to do with issues that were important to citizens in the state, but found out very quickly that the main purpose for getting involved early is to get contributions sufficient so that you can run an effective campaign later on. So probably for the next 8 months or so, I'm going to be very involved, not only in talking to people the second congressional district, but also in trying to get contributions for the campaign itself. And hoping that over that period of time also to have an opportunity to debate Mr. Metcalf, who is the current Republican incumbent for the second congressional district. So you essentially give up the next year of your life to run an effective campaign.
Big sacrifice.
Well, you know, for me, it's a continuation of the public service that I have given for the past 30 years, both as a nurse for nearly 35 years and as a military officer. It is a natural transition from trying to serve the people of this region. And you know, I think many of us look for meaning with our lives and trying to find a way that we can continue to serve and continue to live as good citizens.
Greta Cammermeyer, do you plan to take on President Clinton's policy of don't ask, don't tell in the military?
Well, you know, I'm not going to be a one-issue person. You know, even though there's been a lot of notoriety around the fact of my sexual orientation and that I challenged the military in the past, the don't ask, don't tell policy, for example, is a law. It's the law of the land and is currently being challenged through the courts, and that's the proper place for it at this point. And that I will take on those issues as they come up, as I learn how to be a good representative, will hopefully be well informed as I make decisions on votes that affect citizens of the state of Washington. You know, I am as full a citizen as everyone else and extremely concerned about what's happening here. So the issues that I will be fighting for are those that concern all of us and not a focus in any one area.
Greta Cammermeyer, can you characterize your area in Washington State and Washington State overall politically? I mean, here you were involved with Initiative 677, the Washington State ballot measure that would extend job protections to gay men and lesbians. It went down this year. What is the political climate of Washington?
Well, I think it's a moderate state. I think we live, the second congressional district is in the northwest corner of the state of Washington, where there is a great diversity in citizenship and in who and what some of the issues are. We have islands that are sort of isolated from the mainland, where there is sort of the wanting to protect the environment and just enjoy nature. They have to have private boats to get there because there's no ferry service in some of the regions. We have the Canadian border, which, as you no doubt know at this point, has the potential of being an absolute disaster if it comes to the implementation of the law that was enacted this past year. If it continues to be enacted here, there's going to be a gridlock from in traffic from the Canadian border to the 150 miles south to Seattle if some emergency measure isn't enacted there. We have farmers, we have the Boeing plant, we have military personnel through the Navy Everett home port and the Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. So it's probably as close to a cross-section of what is part of the fabric of all of the United States, I think, sort of put into one little corner of, and I didn't mention the Native American population here. So we have it all.
Final question, Greta Cammermeyer, what about the military budget? Where would you stand on that, and would you be for paring it down?
I think it's always good to relook at what our mission is. We have a global mission to defend democracy, to defend America, and we certainly have to be prepared to do that with a very effective fighting force as well as a very effective standing military. I think with the situation and how it has changed in the world from Vietnam, where I served, to the present day, that we are the only superpower left, I think it's very healthy to relook at how we're going to fight wars and protect democracy and peace, and to make a blanket statement of I would eliminate something or I would build on it, I think is probably a little unwise. I think it's very important to review what we really need, whether that means to relook at Senator, as Secretary Cohen has said, to look at the size of the military, the number of bases that exist, and what we really need to maintain the manpower, woman power, and the standing force, I think is very important to continue to do.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Greta Kammermeier, for joining us. Margaret Kammermeier is a retired Army colonel and co-chair of the campaign for Initiative 677 this year, the Washington State ballot measure that would extend job protections to gay men and lesbians. It went down, but Greta Kammermeier has gone on now to announce her candidacy for Congress in Washington State. I want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at the pepper spray case that we've covered in the last few weeks in Headwaters area of California. Then we're going to get an update on the Judy Barry case, the woman who was blown up in her own car, a member of Earth First, who the FBI contended blew up herself and the person she was driving with. And we're going to find out about a bill in Congress that President Clinton has signed off on and what it would mean exactly for Headwaters. Finally, we'll be talking with Norman Solomon, who wrote the book, The Trouble with Dilbert. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and today we're broadcasting from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. Yes, these are sounds that we've played on Democracy Now! Before, and these are cries of pain. Earlier this month on Democracy Now!, we heard the story of a police assault on environmental protesters who chained themselves down in Congressmember Frank Riggs' office in Eureka, California. A police video which showed the protesters screaming as deputies pulled back their heads, opened their eyes, and applied the burning chemical material pepper spray to their eyeballs sparked outrage and calls for the resignation of the local police chief. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take an extended look at what caused the demonstration in the first place, a battle over the world's last large preserve of unprotected redwood forest located in Northern California, and find out about a judge's decision that was just handed down this past Friday. For 10 years, environmentalists have been battling to stop the planned logging of the Headwaters Forest by Pacific Lumber Maxam Company. Now the Clinton administration has stepped in and offered a deal. Federal and state officials will step in and purchase 7,500 acres out of the 60,000 and institute a habitat conservation fund. We're joined right now by Alicia Littletree, who is with the environmental group Earth First. Ted Nordhaus is with us. He's the executive director of the Headwaters Sanctuary Project, which is bringing the Headwaters issue to a national audience. And we're hoping to be joined by Pacific Lumber, although they are not coming to the phone at the moment. Well, I want to both welcome our guests who are in the studio right now to Pacifica Station KPFA and Democracy Now! Alicia Littletree, let's begin with the latest decision of the judge this past Friday.
Yeah, last Friday we were trying, once again, we were in court trying to get an injunction against the use of pepper spray on nonviolent protesters in the Headwaters struggle. And the injunction was denied by the judge, who said that we hadn't proven any hardship. We haven't proven enough hardship to warrant an injunction.
Well, I just described it a little bit, but can you explain exactly what happened to the protesters on, what was it, three different occasions?
There were three different occasions. Two were office blockade lockdowns, and one was out in the forest in a watershed called Bear Creek. There were people locked down to a bulldozer trying to stop the logging of ancient redwoods out in Bear Creek. Basically, the first time it happened was September 25th, when a group of seven demonstrators went into the Pacific Lumber office in Scotia and locked themselves together with lock boxes, which you described before. They were metal sleeves that we put our hands, we put our arms around something and put our hands inside the metal sleeve and handcuff our hands together. It's very hard for law enforcement to remove us when we're locked down in this way, but we've used this tactic for years and years and years, and they've been able to remove us for years and years and years. So basically what happened this time was they arrived with a very aggressive stance. They put up cardboard in the windows of the office so nobody on the outside could see in, and then they notified the people on the ground that there would be, if they didn't disperse, chemical agents would be used against them. So they gave them 5 minutes, and then a few of the people did unlock themselves at that point, but there were four women still locked together, two by two. And at that point, the sheriff took their heads, bent their heads back, and applied liquid pepper spray to their eyes using Q-tips. And then it was applied again once their tear ducts were open. And then from the story told by the demonstrators who were in, it sounded like the police had a little bit of remorse and then washed their eyes out with water. And the women never unlocked, so they were taken out on stretchers, which they could have been taken out on stretchers from the beginning and made the whole thing unnecessary. It happened again at Frank Riggs's office about a week and a half later. Later, there were four women locked down in Frank Riggs's office around a stump, and the same thing was done.
We tried to get Congressmember Frank Riggs on the show this morning, but he's away with his family. Frank Riggs, what has he said about the pepper spray incident?
Well, he's been incredibly vocal since the incident. As soon as we filed our lawsuit, which made the police videos public and picked up by national press, Frank Riggs came out vehemently in support of law enforcement, and he even called them restrained. Then he went on the floor of Congress and made this outrageous speech where he said there were 60 people who stormed his office and terrorized his staff. Now he's gone on to do this incredible campaign of misinformation about who Earth First is and what our tactics are. He's been, you know, a la 1990, before the bombing of Judy Berry and Daryl Turney, he's been smearing Earth Firsters, calling us violent, calling us terrorists. And, of course, we have a record of perfect nonviolence in this struggle, and he's just trying to make as much violence towards us and stir up as much hatred towards us as possible to justify something that's entirely unjustifiable.
Well, I want to talk about a memo that has surfaced, supposedly under Earth First name, that's coming out that really does relate to the Judy Berry case and the kind of climate that had been building around the time of the bombing of her car. And we're going to talk more specifically about that in a minute. But before we do that, I wanted to bring Ted Nordhaus into the conversation, executive director of Headwater Sanctuary Project, who is here with Alicia Littletree of the environmental group Earth First, to ask you both about what you think about the appropriations bill that was just passed in Washington, D.C., and to ask what the appropriations bill has to do with the Headwaters Forest, what the proposal in it was, which has now become law, to buy 7,500 acres of the 60,000 that constitute the last refuge of ancient redwood.
Well, basically, back in 1996, because of the incredible public outrage about the imminent salvage logging of Headwaters Forest, our Senator Dianne Feinstein and Charles Hurwitz, the CEO of Maxim Corporation, which is the parent company of Pacific Lumber, negotiated a deal to pay Charles Hurwitz millions of dollars hundreds of millions of dollars for 7,500 acres of this 60,000-acre forest. And since the deal came out, and there's kind of a rider in this deal which says that in exchange for the preservation of this 7,500 acres, which is just two groves of the Headwaters Forest, which includes six groves, then Pacific Lumber now gets this thing called a Habitat Conservation Plan, which is actually a license to kill endangered species in exchange for setting aside the 7,500 acres. Then Hurwitz gets to go ahead and clear cut the rest of it. So we've been very opposed to the deal since it was brokered back in 1996.
And explain who Charles Hurwitz is.
Charles Hurwitz is the CEO of Maxim Corporation. Basically what he does is he and Maxim Corporation go around buying companies and liquidating their assets and selling them off. And he did this with Simplicity Patterns and Kaiser Aluminum, and now he's doing it with The Last of the Ancient Redwoods.
Ted Nordhaus, your feelings about the appropriations bill that was just passed and the selling off or the buying that the federal government will do of 7,500 acres?
Well, I should point out that first of all, there were many things wrong with that the environmental community didn't like about the interior appropriation not having anything to do with headwaters. And we, along with most of the rest of the environmental community, urged the president to veto that legislation for those reasons, notwithstanding one's position on the headwaters deal. There were all sorts of riders attached to the interior appropriation that subsidized road building, that increased public subsidies for all kinds of logging activities on federal lands, that opened up national areas of national forest to increased logging. There's a whole litany. And obviously, this has been a strategy that the Republicans in Congress have employed for some time now on environmental issues. Folks may remember back to the inclusion of the salvage logging rider that President Clinton signed into law back in 1995, I believe. But as far as the headwaters deal and the funding that the Interior Appropriation provided for the deal, we have taken, I think, a somewhat more measured approach than have Alicia and some of her cohorts on the issue. We are not supporting the deal, but we're not prepared at this point to dismiss it out of hand, and we think that it's that we should not walk away from the extraordinary amount of money that the state and federal governments have offered to try to resolve this issue lightly. We're prepared to do so if the Habitat Conservation Plan does not extend protections to the rest of the forest, but we have again taken somewhat more of a wait and see approach in terms of not dismissing the Habitat Conservation Plan a priori.
Let me ask Mary Bullwinkle, who has just joined us, spokesperson for Pacific Lumber, what you think of the Interior Appropriations Bill that was just signed, where state and federal officials will step in and purchase 7,500 acres out of the 60,000 that are the last stand of the ancient redwood.
Well, first of all, those 60,000 acres you refer to are not ancient redwoods. In fact, the majority of that acreage is young growth forest. But the Interior Appropriations Bill, we're very pleased that the president has signed it, and that is the federal financial share of this Headwaters Forest Agreement. And now it's up to the state of California to step in and to come up with their share to make this agreement happen.
Alicia Littletree, what are your plans with Earth First around this signed appropriations bill?
Well, we'll continue to oppose it. And the reason why is because there's two things wrong with it, really wrong with it. The first is that it does pay hundreds of millions of dollars to Charles Hurwitz. He's from Houston. He's a CEO of a multinational corporation. And we feel that he bought this company using junk bonds and an illegal junk bond takeover of Pacific Lumber. He's destabilizing the entire fabric of our North Coast rural timber-dependent community by taking the resource out. And we'll continue to oppose anything that gives him more money and lets him profit more off of the liquidation of the ancient redwoods. Mary Bullwinkle's right. There isn't a contiguous 60,000-acre ancient redwood forest left anywhere. That what we're fighting for is fragments of a very decimated ecosystem. But without those fragments, we won't be able to build it, and the resource base will be eliminated. The other thing is this Habitat Conservation Plan. I think it's kind of foolish to hold out any hope that the Habitat Conservation Plan will be in any way biologically viable for this ecosystem, especially because we're talking about fragments. The Habitat Conservation Plan is a strategy to dismantle the Endangered Species Act and allow multinational extractive corporations to go into areas that are previously off limits to taking the last of the ecosystem, to endangered habitat, because existing environmental law already protects these forests. And this whole deal that's been brokered is a way for Hurwitz to get at it. It's not a way to protect it. It's a way to eliminate four of the six groves that are left.
Mary Bullwinkle?
Well, Well, we believe that we're our habitat conservation plan will address the environmental issues that are so important. I mean, there is more to the forest than the trees, and we're very well aware of that. And our biologist and some of the top biologists from throughout the country are working very diligently on this habitat conservation plan and to address those issues.
Ted Nordhaus of Headwater Sanctuary Project.
I just have to point out a couple of things. I mean, the first is that I need to make it, it should be made very clear that the habitat conservation plan that has been submitted to the federal government by Pacific Lumber is a total non-starter. And that's not just the environmental community's position on it, but that's been the position of the relevant federal agencies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. I also have to take issue a little bit with the assumption that the Habitat Conservation Plan is going to allow Pacific Lumber to cut four of the six unprotected redwood groves in Headwaters Forest. In fact, again, to date, the agencies have been unwilling to sign off on allowing Pacific Lumber to cut any of those groves. And I think we just have to remember that, yes, to date, the Endangered Species Act over the last, just literally over the last several years, has extended some protection to what remains of the old growth forest in Headwaters, what remains of the old growth redwoods in Headwaters Forest. But that's been the result of a very protracted legal strategy on the part of the environmental community. And I think that while obviously we're going to continue to work to extend those protections through ongoing litigation, it's not something that you can necessarily take to the bank. And again, in the case of this particular habitat conservation plan, and we'll be the first to acknowledge that the history of these habitat conservation plans is not good. They have in many cases been used to skirt restrictions put in place by the Endangered Species Act. But in this particular case, one has to recognize that the habitat conservation plan is attached to a very large purchase agreement, and if Pacific Lumber wishes to see that purchase go forward and to get some return for the lands that they propose to turn over to the federal government, they're going to need to agree to a fairly strong plan. If the administration is unwilling to insist upon strong protections for the rest of the forest through the habitat conservation plan, we will be the first to lead the fight to kill the entire deal and make sure that Pacific Lumber gets no money out of it. But again, I think that it's worth remembering that there are some real unique circumstances around the negotiation of this plan that haven't been there in the past.
Mary Bullwinkle, I'm sorry you came late into the conversation, and we just have a minute to go. But I wanted to go back for a minute to the conversation we had at the beginning around the pepper spray case. Since one of the protests that took place in the last few months occurred on your property in Eureka, California, where the protesters were there and the sheriff's deputies took them, pulled their heads back and Q-tip their eyes with pepper spray. We wanted to ask what Pacific Lumber's position on this was.
Well, we feel it's a law enforcement issue. We feel that that was a decision that was made by the law enforcement at the end of a multi-hour sit-in, if you will. And it was a decision that was made by the law enforcement after giving those folks who had come into our office and refused to leave ample opportunity to leave.
Well, they gave the warnings, true, to leave, but does that then entitle them to be able to do anything they want to the protesters?
Well, it's not my job to second guess what law enforcement decisions are. In fact, that's what the federal judge recently said in this case. It's not his job to second guess the law enforcement's decisions, and that's our position.
Alicia Littletree, it was law enforcement, although it was on the property of Pacific Lumber. Do you hold Pacific Lumber responsible?
Well, we've seen law enforcement come to, you know, the beck and call of Pacific Lumber since the struggle began back in 1986. And actually, if, you know, if we're going to call specifics on this, Pacific Lumber's chief of security, Carl Anderson, was right there making these plans with law enforcement, putting up the cardboard on the windows to prevent the outside people from seeing into the office. And this is all being done for the service of Pacific Lumber and Charles Hurwitz.
Mary Bowwinkle?
I'm not aware of that.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up this part of the conversation. I'm going to ask Alicia Littletree to stay with us for just a minute after the break so we can get an update on the Judy Barry case, since it is developing. And then we'll be joined by Norman Solomon to talk about his new book, The Trouble with Dilbert, How Corporate Culture Gets the Last Laugh. I want to thank Ted Nordhaus, Executive Director of the Headwater Sanctuary Project, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Mary Bowwinkle, spokesperson for Pacific Lumber in Eureka, California, for being with us on the telephone.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from Berkeley, California for the rest of the week. We're just finishing up our conversation now with Alicia Littletree of the environmental group Earth First to get an update on the Judy Barry case. We want to play a little of Judy Barry's speech, but Alicia, give us a little background for listeners around the country who aren't familiar with Judy.
Well, Judy Barry was a well-known Earth First organizer. She was kind of catapulted into a national spotlight in 1990 when she and her companion Daryl Cherney were driving through Oakland on a Redwood Summer organizing tour, and a motion-triggered car bomb exploded underneath Judy's seat. Judy was a labor organizer and brought her labor organizing experience to the Redwood region and was forging an alliance with timber workers and environmentalists. And it was an incredible alliance. It was very dangerous to the power of the timber corporations in our area. So as soon as the bomb exploded, within 15 minutes, the FBI arrived on the scene. And basically within 3 hours, Judy Barry was under arrest for transporting explosives, basically for carrying the bomb that was used to try to kill her. So for 8 weeks, these tremendous charges were trumpeted in the national media. You know, they were called everything from, you know, bombers to terrorists. Earth First was smeared as a terrorist organization. And with the 8 weeks later, the FBI couldn't come up with any evidence, and the district attorney of Alameda County refused to press charges. But instead of investigating who actually put the bomb in her car, the FBI seized on the opportunity to then go ahead and investigate the environmental community.
Judy Barry died this past year of cancer, but her words and her legacy continue, as does a lawsuit that she filed along with Daryl Cherney. Let's hear the words of Judy Barry. This is at a protest that took place. Was this at Headwaters?
I'd have to hear it. But
let's take a listen.
When we were bombed, we were organizing for something called Redwood Summer, which I hope a lot of you have heard of. It was 6 years ago. I know that's pretty old. But at any rate, Redwood Summer was planned in response to the timber companies having an accelerated cutting schedule, to put it mildly. In Mendocino County, where I live, they were cutting at three times the rate of growth. They were cutting faster than they are now because they don't have any trees left there anymore. Headwaters Forest was being threatened. That was one of the issues that was going on then. A lot of activists and EPIC and other groups had gotten together a voter initiative called Forest Forever, and the timber companies planned on cutting down every tree they could that summer so that the vote would be as moot as possible if it won. So our plan with Redwood Summer was to block every tree from being cut down that we could. The plan was to physically slow them down using nonviolent civil disobedience to try to make sure that there was something left.
And that is Judy Barry.
Yeah, she's explaining a bit of the background of the campaign they were working on when the bomb exploded.
So tell us, as we wrap up, Alicia, about her lawsuit and where it stands today.
Well, in 1991, they filed a civil rights lawsuit in federal court against the FBI and the Oakland Police Department, who worked hand-in-hand with the FBI, to make a false arrest, illegal search, and also a conspiracy charge, a conspiracy to violate their First Amendment rights to organize for Earth First. So far, this lawsuit has survived three attempts to have it thrown out, and then this latest decision that was made was a motion that we filed asking Judge Claudia Wilkin to certify that the FBI and Oakland Police don't have immunity from prosecution. And of course, the standard of immunity for law enforcement is very high. She just ruled 4 weeks ago that, in fact, they don't have immunity, and we're going to go ahead and take them to trial. So this is a great victory, definitely of national significance to anyone who's watching the FBI, the latest lab scandals and revelations about what they're up to and Ruby Ridge and everything like that. We're going to be taking these people to trial, but this is the most significant charge here is the conspiracy charge, because it shows a resurgence of the notorious COINTELPRO counterintelligence program by the FBI in the 1990s. Probably not a resurgence. It's probably just been happening since it happened to the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement, putting away Leonard Peltier. But basically, we want to expose this, that they're still up to it, that it was never stopped.
And what do you see evidence of it today, right now?
We have an incredible documented case of COINTELPRO against Judy Barry, Daryl Cherney, and Earth First. And specifically, now we're seeing a kind of a resurgence of it in our area around the whole pepper spray issue, because you mentioned this fake leaflet that had been circulated. Basically, what this fake leaflet does is it has Earth First's address and phone number wrong, but it connects us with equipment sabotage, violence, the Unabomber even. I mean, they're throwing
everything
at us.
So under your letterhead.
Exactly.
It connects you to the Unabomber.
Right. And we found this back in August. It was given to me by another Earth Firster up in Arcata. And I put it in a packet with other fakes that look a lot like it that were circulated in 1990 before the bomb exploded to whip up a climate of fear and hatred in our community and kind of set the stage for something like the bombing attack. I put those fakes from 1990, along with this year's fake, in a packet with an FBI file that shows that the FBI knew that the 1990 leaflets were fakes, handed it to Humboldt County Sheriff Dennis Lewis, who is a defendant in the pepper spray case, and asked him to investigate back in August. In fact, just yesterday I talked with the Sheriff Gary Philp, who's also a named defendant in the case, and I said, Riggs is circulating this. He sent it out with press release. Right. And the Sheriff's Department can put an end to it by saying they know who we are. They know we're nonviolent. They know we're not terrorists. And so I ask that they make that statement.
Well, we'll be waiting.
Right.
And we'll let people
know
if that statement is made. Here on Democracy Now!, Alicia Littletree, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Alicia Littletree of the environmental group Earth First. Well, I have to say it's really great to be out here in Berkeley, California, even if when we came in last night it was pouring rain and as cold as it has been in New York. But it's wonderful to get to actually see some of the faces of the people that we talk to on the telephone and get a chance to interview from time to time. One of those faces who is now sitting here with Body in the studio is Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon, a nationally syndicated columnist and author. He's co-author with Jeff Cohen of the Wizards of Media Oz, Behind the Curtain of Mainstream News. But today he's here to talk about his latest book, and it's called The Trouble with Dilbert. The cartoon strip Dilbert has emerged from a small daily strip 8 years ago to a multimedia and multi-billion dollar titan. It now appears in some 1,700 papers, and Dilbert books are regularly on the bestseller list. The hook of the strip is its main character, supposedly an alienated and somewhat nerdy white-collar worker toiling in an absurd bureaucracy. Newsweek has called the strip the worst PR for corporate America since the Exxon Valdez oil spill. But Norman, you don't agree.
Well, it's actually great PR for corporate America, and I think the whole Dilbert empire, the so-called Dilbert phenomenon, is really a window into how mass-marketed popular or so-called popular culture really operates within these constraints. I mean, just as Dilbert is inside a cubicle, or you might say minimum security of the workplace, the entire range of potential creativity that people have is cubicled up into a very narrow range. And in fact, if you look at the Dilbert material, the comics, the books, the knickknacks, the management seminars, the pronouncements of the Dilbert creator, Scott Adams, you see a real affirmation of corporate values in the guise of opposing corporate domination. And in a way, I think that's a paradigm that we can look at across the board and see ways that the outer limits of opposition to the corporate system are presented by the corporate media as being very, in fact, transcendent when they're really quite mild and quite subservient.
Why did you decide to write a whole book on Dilbert? I mean, that gives it even more attention, though I'm sure your book doesn't need to add to the attention to Dilbert.
Well, I think it really is a window in. I mean, in its own right, Dilbert is much more than a comic strip. It has become not only a mass-marketed product, but also something that's been internalized by millions of people, and now it's global. I mean, I did an interview yesterday with Voice of America about Dilbert for this precise reason, that 51 countries now publish the Dilbert comic strip, and it's a way of responding to corporatization and really economic globalization. It's a marketed affect. I call it passive resistance without the resistance. It's responding to real lack of democracy in the workplace, gross inequities, increasing imbalances of power, not with unionization, not with finding out how we can work together to right these wrongs, but rather it's what I call part of the culture of eye-rolling capitulation, the sarcasm, the acid quips, lets each person fend for themselves. And this is really a value system that's being promoted.
It appeared earlier this week that looks at your book and also talks to Scott Adams, who is the creator of Dilbert. And he says, I can't tell you how amusing this has all been for me. I make my own living by being a demagogue, and I think it's funny that someone else is making his living demagoguing me. I fully support his effort.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess Scott Adams can speak for himself about what he's up to. Here we've got someone who is hooked not only to HarperCollins publisher owned by Rupert Murdoch, which is distributing millions of his books, but also has cut dozens of major deals with outfits like Intel and Xerox, outfits that are perpetrating on their workforce exactly the kind of suppression that supposedly Dilbert is opposing as a cultural phenomenon. So he has really aligned himself not with unions, not with working people, not with those who are trying to deal with the absurdity and the repression often of the workplace. He's aligned himself with the downpressers, with the corporate powers that be.
One of the things you say in your book, The Trouble with Dilbert, is that Scott Adams actually favors downsizing.
Yeah, I asked him earlier this year, point blank, to explain what had been very cryptically referred to in a Newsweek article the previous year, where he is said to believe that downsizing is a positive thing in some cases. And I quote in my book his full response, where he said that, yes, he thinks that downsizing can be good, that when he worked at Pacific Bell Telephone Company in California, he experienced a decrease in bureaucracy after a wave of downsizing at that company. In other words, he's saying that if you don't get the pink slip, then downsizing is actually quite positive. And I think that is emblematic of a lot of the subtext of Dilbert, which is, hey, we're all out for ourselves. And this is not only a subtext of the cartoon, but let's remember that Scott Adams is hired to do management seminars around the country. As Business Week says, CEOs love to see Dilbert on the walls of the workers. CEOs put Dilbert on their walls because, in a way, Dilbert is a stealth weapon at this point that can go where whip-cracking supervisors can't go. There's no mystery that there's cynicism and alienation in the workplace. And so, for instance, the Xerox Corporation has put Dilbert comic strips into their official training manuals as a way to reach out to workers and say, we know you have cynicism and skepticism, but isn't the real problem of the workplace inefficiency? And this is a major theme of the entire Dilbert body of work, that if only we could have more efficiency, then the workplace would be right. Well, this is a management ethic from time immemorial, that if workers could just work harder and function more efficiently, then they wouldn't have anything to be worried about.
Norman Solomon, if you were a cartoonist, what would you draw Dilbert doing?
Well, I think we would we could creatively draw Dilbert or create other cartoons that would look at a whole host and range of issues. As a matter of fact, In Chapter 4 of this book, The Trouble with Dilbert, there's an essay by Bob Harris, who is a comedian. He makes his living from comedy, and he has listed issues that rarely or never get included in Dilbert, and they include export of jobs to cheap labor markets, outsourcing to prison labor, outsourcing to workfare labor, racism in the workplace, union busting, corporate welfare, repetitive stress injuries, urine testing, sexual harassment. As a matter of fact, in the Dilbert books, and these are essays by Scott Adams in his best-selling books, he has gone out of his way to make fun of training against sexual harassment. He has made fun of diversity training or training against racism on the job. And it's not just a matter of a quip. He actually says that they're totally a waste of time and that they're taking up the good energy and time of staff people whose efforts would be better put to use making more money for the company. And I think this is another theme that a creative comic or cultural work in general could deconstruct and attack rather than perpetrate, as Dilbert does. And that's the idea that if you really want to be rebellious, you will overcome the opposition of middle management and make more money for the company. And in the book, I talk about this as a pattern. It's not only Dilbert. It's a place like Wired Magazine, which is supposed to be very hip and avant-garde, where last spring they had a cover story called Corporate Rebels. Well, in this new Wired world, this internalized corporate power world, who are put forward as the ultimate rebels toward the corporate system? It's people who fight against middle management and old-fashioned ideas in the workplace and actually struggle to create new products that will make more profits for top management and investors and stockholders. Well, where a lot of people come from in their gut and at the grassroots, that's not rebellion. That's something very different.
Do you see a cartoon out there, a national cartoon, that you would commend, for example, Doonesbury?
Well, I think, you know, Doonesbury has taken some good shots, for instance, in recent months at the Nike ownership around the factories around the planet that have been really, there's no better word, exploiting and oppressing workers, whether in Vietnam and elsewhere. So Doonesbury has done some good work. The cover of the book, The Trouble with Dilbert, that I've just done is by Matt Worker, a great political cartoonist, Tom Tomorrow as well. And these are folks who are really going after the corporate power structure. And you can rest assured they're not going to be cutting deals with Intel, as Scott Adams has done.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Norman Solomon, for being with us. Norman Solomon's book is called The Trouble with Dilbert, How Corporate Culture Gets the Last Laugh. At the top of it, it says, this book has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that publishes the Dilbert works by Scott Adams. And it's published by Common Courage Press, an independent press that is based in Maine. Thank you very much, Norman.
Thank you, Amy.
And it's nice to actually see you.
Same here.
And by the way, I want to give out the number of the Mendocino Environmental Center, which can get you all the latest information on the pepper spray case. And that number is 707-468-1660. That's 707-468-1660. And while you have your pens out, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, that's a cassette copy, you can order it by calling the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Kevin Cartwright was our engineer here in Berkeley, California, at Pacifica Station KPFA. Thanks also to Julia Hutton. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!